You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 26th of March, 2024, on Monocle Radio. It is 2000 in Taipei, 1500 in Sana'a, midday here in London, and 9 a.m. in Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program, Israel considers controversial legislation that would exempt religious students from conscription. We'll look at how the exemptions are being viewed in Israeli society. After that, we speak to a former Australian general about how China is upgrading its military. We get a report on declining birth rates around the world, and then...
When we read reports from human rights organizations or stories from local journalists, maybe we don't always think about the importance of bearing witness, but also how hard it can be to bear witness.
The Yemen Listening Project aims to give voice to ordinary Yemenis bearing witness to 9 years of conflict. We'll speak to the organizers and hear from some of the Yemenis included in the project. And finally, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here to review the Latin American papers. What have you found, Faye?
Hello, Chris. Today we speak about Macron's state visit to Brazil, plus Bolsonaro's strange stay at the Hungarian embassy.
Some other big news as well, I can tell you. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. The question of conscription is one that faces a number of countries around the world these days, from Ukraine and Europe to the Middle East. And with the return of conscription also comes the question of who should be exempt. Israel's government is this week proposing legislation that would enshrine an exemption for religious students into law. The exemption was struck down by Israel's Supreme Court, but it is backed by the ultra-Orthodox parties in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Well, I'm joined for more on this now by Paul Rogers, Open Democracy's international security expert. Paul, thanks so much, as always, for coming on the show. Let's start with kind of the numbers here. The number of students that are claiming religious exemption has soared from 400 to around 66,000. That can't be right, can it? The Orthodox population has grown, but surely not by that much.
Well, it is right. If you say 400, that was at the time of Israel's independence. And the number of people who were on the strict Orthodox side was relatively small. But of course, the population was relatively small then. It was only, I think, about 300,000 Jews at the time. One of the things to realize is that prior to the development of Zionism and immigration into Israel from the 1890s, before that, the Jewish population of Palestine was only about 22,000-23,000 out of a total population of only 400,000. Most of those Jews were basically religious Jews. They tended to be in Jerusalem or Nablus or one or two other places, and they got on with their worship and their studies. And they formed the basis for this expansion. And the expansion has come partly from all the immigration into Israel, but also from a much higher birth rate among the ultra-Orthodox Jews, where the number of children per family is something like six. And they currently make up, well, about 10% of the population directly controlled by Israel, or essentially about 13% of the Jewish population. So it's a sizable minority, but it's because of the birth rate that you have very large numbers of young people. And so you put that together with what's happening in the war, which is the other matter, and you can see the pressures on Netanyahu at the present time.
You absolutely can. And then to get to the exemption here, how has the controversy around the exemption kind of changed over this time? Is it about the exemption per se, or is it more about how it's applied? I mean, is there sort of a more limited exemption that could be applied here? How does also what Israel is doing now, the government, get around the Supreme Court's ruling on it?
Well, this is a problem. It doesn't. It's one of the reasons why, I think, you remember, there was all the controversy last year about changing the powers of the Supreme Court. And that was partly really to satisfy these sort of factions. The thing about Israeli governmental politics is it has a very low threshold for countries to actually take up seats. It's only about 3.25% of the population. If you get that number of votes in an election, then you can get seats apportioned. Now, if you take in the EU, Germany, I think, is about 5%, which is much more typical. And so you have the present situation with two religious parties, one very pro-settler and the other under Bezalel Smotrich, which is essentially very religious and holds onto the orthodox views, and they hold the balance of power. That's the key to this. Combine that with the fact that the war is proving very difficult for Israel, far more difficult than they admit in public, and they find it difficult to provide the human power, the personnel, so to speak, at the front line, when they're also having to concern themselves with a possible attack from Hezbollah in the north, and also the ongoing instability and, frankly, violence, part of it settler orientated, on the West Bank. Put it all together, and essentially Netanyahu has to do two things at the same time: make sure there are enough troops to fight the war, which isn't going right, but also satisfy his coalition, which includes these groups, particularly, I think, Smotrich's party, that are absolutely intent on making sure that these exemptions do stay. Netanyahu is trying to sort of mix it a little bit by saying there will be, the exemptions might not be quite so complete, but he isn't getting away with that, which is why you have the intensity of the debate here in the Knesset.
Well, you mentioned the two things that Netanyahu has to balance there, the military and the politics side, but there is also then the side of the Israeli society. I mean, how is this being seen among the population? How controversial are these exemptions for the population more broadly?
In the normal way, I think they would be quite controversial. In fact, they'd be seriously controversial. Many Jews in Israel do not regard themselves as sort of devout followers of Judaism. They're much more secular. It varies a lot, and you have all the different denominations. But essentially, so in the normal way, I think there will be a lot of opposition. And as the numbers have grown, as you say, 66,000 of the people in the yeshiva, the seminaries, who essentially are wanting this exemption, then that would be the case. It is different at the moment because of still the sheer shock of what happened on October the 7th. And essentially, Israelis as a whole would probably be rather more lenient to this position. But again, they're rather torn because many would see the huge importance basically of the nature of Israel as a Judaic state, but at the same time, the way in which they will be having to have more periods in with conscription, longer periods in reserve, grates as well. It's when you put these together, the combination of the politics, particularly the Knesset, and I know I'm coming back to this again, the problem is that the war is not going the way that Israel expected and is having huge difficulty, which is why it has also the problem of the UN resolution over yesterday, which for the first time is putting pretty serious pressure on the Israeli government simply because of what the United States agreed this time to abstain. And there's quite cold fury on the part of many of the Netanyahu supporters on what the US has done because they expected support. Put it all together, and it is very tricky politics for Netanyahu. But at the same time, he has an extraordinary ability to get out of these things, and he may well do it again.
Just finally, Paul, I wonder if you could put this in a bit of an international context in terms of how Israel uses conscription. There's always this question of whether conscription or an actual professional army is better. And then beyond that as well, I mean, whether religious exemption is a thing in other countries or not. I mean, you do have things like conscientious objectors, objectors or a civilian service option in most countries. Why is that sort of not a thing in Israel?
I think it's the nature of the Israeli state. I mean, from the start, right back from 1948, in fact, right back from the problems in the 1930s, Israelis in what was then Palestine, now in Israel, have put an absolute premium on their own security. There is this phrase, which in some ways is quite good, that Israel is a unique state and it is impregnable in its insecurity. It has to be absolutely impregnable because there is always the insecurity of its position in the Middle East. And this is why you can't really compare it to most other countries. And as a sense, you get this kind of situation where the Israelis will take far more in terms of the militaristic side than you might expect. Coupled with that Israel is a very important arms exporter. And to be very blunt about it, it has used its occupation of Palestinian territories to show how it can maintain control. And that's a worry now because of the grievous failure from that point of view at the time of 7th of October. So you end up, I'm afraid, with a very difficult situation. Israelis feel it is absolutely essential to be secure, but they are not at present. And the wider worry is they're becoming almost a pariah state because of the way they've been treating the Palestinians with, well, 32,000 killed that we know about, and at least 5,000 apparently buried under the rubble. So put it all together, and as I say, Netanyahu is in a very particular, very difficult position.
Paul, thanks very much. That was the international security expert, Paul Rogers. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Rescue workers in Baltimore are searching for around 20 people and multiple vehicles believed to have fallen into the Patapsco River after a major bridge collapsed in the city of Baltimore. A large section of the Francis Scott Key Bridge fell into the river earlier today in what authorities have described as a developing mass casualty event. The UN Security Council passed a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza during the months of Ramadan, as well as immediate release of hostages. America abstained, allowing the vote to pass. In response, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cancelled plans to send an Israeli delegation to Washington. And Japan's Imperial Household Agency is launching an official Instagram account. The social media account, which will start operating on the 1st of April, will feature photos of Emperor Naruhito and Empress Masako's activities, as well as pictures of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. For a few years now, US military officials have been warning that a conflict between China and Taiwan could come to a head in 2027, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Liberation Army and the date that China has set as a goal to build a world-class military. Since the start of this year, China has stepped up military exercises in and around Taiwanese airspace, and last week the top US admiral in the region said all indications point to China's military being ready by 2027 as planned. After Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the question now is whether anything can avoid the start of a second major conflict with a great power. Well, joining me now from Brisbane is Mick Ryan, a retired Australian Major General and the author of White Sun War, The Campaign for Taiwan. General Ryan, great to have you on the show. Let's start with what you've just made of China's military exercises this year. Are they of a different character than previous ones?
Well, hello. It's great to be with you. What we've seen over the last decade or so is the Chinese are broadening and intensifying their joint exercises, that is, exercises that include land, sea and air capabilities, and undoubtedly space and cyberspace. So what we've seen is the progression this year of a range of activities they've been undertaking up until this point. So they are new, but every year's exercises are now new as they increase their capacity as each year goes by.
And it is clear that China is increasing its capacity, building up its military, which, you know, arguably is its right as a major power. But how sure are we that China is also priming for an actual war?
Well, the direction from President Xi was to be ready by 2027, not do something in 2027. So I think it's very important that we caveat these discussions around what might be called the 2027 problem with that Xi wants the option to be able to unify Taiwan with China, not reunify. Taiwan's never been part of the People's Republic, but to unify with it. We should also remember, too, that at the start of the war in Ukraine, many analysts thought that Russia would not invade Ukraine because it didn't appear ready. So, you know, China kind of might be ready in 2027, but if it feels there is an opportunity beforehand, even if it doesn't look ready to outside observers, it still might launch something in the Taiwan area.
And what is your impression then of how the West should navigate both of those, the 2027 problem, as you call it, but also whether something might or might not happen beforehand? I mean, Joe Biden has suggested, as U.S. presidents do, that the U.S. may come to Taiwan's defense. Is that something that they need to make more explicit at some point? I mean, there is an argument that Ukraine, when you mentioned Ukraine and Russia, Ukraine may have been perhaps saved if the U.S. had said they would come to Ukraine's defense.
Yeah, I mean, the current U.S. approach to Taiwan really is a leftover from 30 or 40 years ago when the Taiwanese and the Chinese militaries were roughly equal in their capabilities, and it was about deterring both sides from attacking each other. But it's also about deterring Taiwan from arbitrarily declaring independence, which might provoke the Chinese into some kind of action. So the US administration really has to walk a careful line between not giving the Taiwanese a reason to declare independence because it's guaranteed that the US will come to their aid, but at the same time, having a sufficient deterrent against Chinese action. And that really is the order of the day now, is deterring the Chinese from doing something precipitous that might plunge us all into some kind of catastrophe in the Western Pacific.
And when you speak of deterrence, I mean, is there a danger also in terms of deterrence of the risk of this kind of being overblown? As you said, we shouldn't focus necessarily on 2027 being a moment of action. And I just wonder if one can almost, you know, create a fait accompli by warning and training for the kind of thing you're trying so hard to prevent.
Well, there's always that risk. And once again, the historical precedents, you know, the start of the First World War, you know, some have speculated it was about mobilization and train tables. It was a bit more sophisticated than that. But you do run that kind of risk that in preparing for something, you might make it a fait accompli. But in reality, governments really only have two choices. They can be underprepared for some kind of eventuality, like a Chinese action against Taiwan, and be caught surprised and not be able to do something, or they can be overprepared and do that in the aim of deterring something that might happen. So most countries, most clever ones, come down on the side of being too prepared rather than being unprepared. And I think that is the right approach.
And tell us a little more about those preparations then on the side of the West, the US, but also allies like Australia. I mean, how have their preparations changed? Is part of the preparation now actually gaming for a potential military confrontation with China itself?
Well, I think what you've seen in particular over the last decade, the old Pacific Command was renamed Indo-PACOM, which really brought in the Indian Ocean, but in particular the Indians into the game, which has been an important part of US strategy in dealing with China. You've seen all elements of Indo-Pacific Command really increase their readiness and assume what they call a fight-to-night posture. That is a very open and transparent approach to say to the Chinese, listen, if you get up tomorrow morning and think about it, please decide you don't want to do anything today. So there's that very transparent change in readiness from US forces. But at the same time, the US has been reinforcing the hub and spoke of alliances and security partnerships it has throughout the Western Pacific, whether it's with its Japanese allies, whether it's with its allies in Australia, or a range of security partners that it has from the, you know, from the Philippines, Vietnam, Singapore, and other countries, to try and have this mesh of relationships that constrains Chinese action, not contains them, but constrains aggressive action. There's no NATO-like organization in the Western Pacific or in Asia. It's unlikely to be. But this mesh of relationships hopefully will deter something catastrophic in our region.
And just finally, when you speak of that mesh of relationships, I also just wonder what the sort of broader risk here is. I mean, one could make an argument that Taiwan is this special kind of unique case, given that China has claimed Taiwan and wanted unification for so long. But is there an assumption in the region that China would not stop there? Is that a reason why this sort of matters, the preparation for this matters?
Well, you could argue that all democracies are special and unique. And if one's worth defending, they all are. I think there is an increasing concern in the region around Chinese coercion. You've seen countries from the Philippines to Indonesia to Japan all increasing their defence budgets, but also taking measures to deter Chinese military coercion. Now, of course, on the economic side of things, every country in our region has China as its major trading partner. So there's a careful balancing between economic relationships and deterring military confrontation in the Western Pacific.
Mick Ryan, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. The decline in birth rates around the world is something that probably keeps a fair amount of government ministers up at night wondering how to reverse the trend. And a new study in the Lancet Journal now confirms that 3/4 of countries could face the problem of their fertility rates falling below population replacement levels by 2050. Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Melanie Channon, a demographer and social statistician at the University of Bath. Melanie, thanks very much for coming on the program. Tell us more about the projections that we're seeing now in this study. Are they new, surprising?
I wouldn't say that they're new or surprising. We've known for a long time that fertility rates are falling. These are slightly different projections to the ones we've seen before. So the UN projects that the global fertility rate will be 2.1 in 2050, which is that kind of magical replacement level. These new projections in the Lancet say that the fertility rate will be 1.8 by 2050 and as low as 1.6 by 2100. So they are talking about much quicker rates of falling fertility than the UN has previously talked about.
And I suppose that is the key, isn't it? Even if it's only, say, 3/4 of countries that are facing fertility rates below replacement levels, if in general the overall population is falling below that 2% level, I mean, what kind of impact does that have on the global economy?
Well, I think what we're looking at here is the twin issue of population aging. So by 2050, over 65s are going to outnumber the under fives by 2 to 1. And in high income countries, you're looking at much more pronounced population aging. We're also looking at population decline. We're looking at maybe 60 countries or more having their populations decline by 2050. And it's going to be the norm to see population decline by 2100. Even the UN projects that global population is going to peak in 2080. That said, we also think we're going to add about 2 billion people to the global population by the 2080s. So it's not as if we're looking at some catastrophic population decline. We're looking at very large numbers of people and also increasing numbers of people for many years to come.
Very large numbers of people. And also, I mean, yes, on the one hand, as we always talk about, there are wealthier nations where the population is declining. But of course, this doesn't necessarily have to impact their economies if we allow more immigration to keep the population sort of somewhat balanced. Do you expect that to be more of a discussion and maybe different from the way we've been having this discussion currently?
I do think there is an interesting potential for the discussion about migration to change somewhat when we see the incredibly high levels of population aging going on in higher income countries, and we see that people in, say, sub-Saharan Africa are still having quite large numbers of children. We might start to think that actually we should be encouraging the migration of young people and families from those areas. So it's going to be interesting to see where the discourse goes. That said, I don't think that migration is going to solve all of our problems in terms of population aging and population decline. We really need to be looking at a wider suite of social policies to address those issues.
And what are the reasons that some countries, particularly like, for example, Japan and South Korea, are more impacted by this than others? And is there anything they can do to reverse this trend?
So, yeah, there are countries that have had very low fertility rates for a very long time, and Japan and South Korea are obvious examples of those. The specific reasons why they have such low fertility rates are multifaceted, but some of the main ones revolve around the fact that women still bear the bulk of things like childcare responsibilities, and actually they would much rather concentrate on their careers. If you look at countries that are slightly more gender equal after marriage and in terms of caring responsibilities, then they tend to have slightly higher fertility rates. Those countries have tried a lot of different policies to encourage an increase in their fertility rate. So South Korea has tried, cash for childbirth, vouchers for babysitting, vouchers for nappies, postpartum care expenses, and all sorts of other things. But none of those have had a terribly substantial impact on their fertility rate.
And just finally, Melanie, so the one side is what you're talking about there in terms of how to encourage a rising birth rate. The other side is just perhaps how you mitigate this in a society if birth rates are falling. Is there anything we can do there aside from simply accepting that perhaps our pensions are going to be lower than they are currently?
Well, we can't rely on an endless supply of young labour to generate growth. That's become very clear, and we can't rely on that to prop up our pension system. So I think what we need to do is concentrate on healthy and active ageing. We need to focus on well-being and participation as well, rather than just never-ending growth. As populations start to decline, that never-ending growth is just not realistic anymore.
Melanie Channon, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This is The Briefing, and I'm Chris Chermak. This week marks 9 years since the start of Yemen's civil war, and to mark the occasion, the New Humanitarian has released what it's calling the Yemen Listening Project. It's a batch of some 100 recordings of ordinary Yemenis describing their daily life and experiences through nearly a decade of conflict. I spoke with the project's two coordinators, Annie Slemrod and Nuha Al-Junaid.
My name is Annie Slemrod. I am Middle East editor at the New Humanitarian, which is a nonprofit newsroom that covers humanitarian crises and the aid industry. And I'm director of the Yemen Listening Project.
I'm Nuha Al-Junaid from Yemen. I am the project coordinator for the Yemen Listening Project with the New Humanitarian Organization. And I've been coordinating this project for the last couple of months with the organization. Personally, I'm a mother of a young child, 3 years old, and I'm living in the Netherlands as a refugee. And professionally, I'm also a human resources advisor. I met with Annie, and she shared with me this idea about the project, and I felt really excited about it because it touched something inside me and a suffering that I've also been through as a Yemeni. It started last year in June with a simple question: how has the war impacted Yemenis' life?
It's been really important to me from the start, I should say, that this project is done with Yemenis, you know, using Yemeni capacity and make sense as a project in Yemen. And I feel like, I don't know if Nuha agrees, but the first time that we met, we sort of got it. We were like, yes, we can do this together.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So we set out trying to think of how we can reach people really where they're at. So we set up a dedicated Yemeni WhatsApp line because Nuha told me, you know, that's really how a lot of Yemenis communicate, manned by Nuha. So people could send in voice notes, messages, really whatever.
My name is Tariq. I'm in Aden. When the war in Yemen began, I planned to stay in my Aden home. I didn't want to leave, but my aunt convinced me to flee for the sake of my children, who were constantly afraid of the fighting around us. So I took a few belongings and left.
To be honest, I could relate myself to each and every story, not personally only, but also because I have lived in Yemen. I was born and raised, lived in Yemen, and I have seen such stories. But the only maybe thing that really surprised me was, despite all that pain they have gone through, they still have hope. And they can still have this faith that things will be better. And this is, as Annie said, persistence. And one of the things that also not surprised me, but of course, let's say I saw it or I sensed it in the stories, that were Yemeni women.
I borrowed some money from a friend and gave it to my husband so he could buy and sell various small things. But before the war, he had worked in a bank and he didn't want to change. So I started selling water.
Yemeni women are incredible. They have showed in the war that they are maybe more resilient and also proactive in changing the situation that they're in. So I can relate to one story of Tariq in Aden.
My efforts encouraged my husband, and we ended up working together. I suffered so much, but I changed too. I'm stronger. I have 5 children, and I was able to take care of them. They are no longer young. For now, at least, things are better.
My name is Manal, and I'm in Hudaydah. I cannot remember the first day of the war. It's blurry to me, a sad day that eats at my heart, my emotions, my memory.
I've been thinking a lot about the story from a woman named Manal in Hudaydah. She talks about a job that she got several years into the war, where she was working, recording violations, I guess we call them, during the war. And she went to a hospital to meet with fishermen who had been impacted by the war, because Hodeidah is on the Red Sea, where there's currently this conflict over shipping. And she ended up sort of accidentally meeting with a soldier who was badly burned and had lost several limbs.
I pushed open the door and found a young man inside. He had half a body and his face was burned, but he was still handsome. I opened my notebook, introduced myself, and began my questions.
I've actually been in a military hospital in Yemen once, and I think her story has made me think a lot about, you know, when we read reports from human rights organizations or stories from local journalists, maybe we don't always think about the mental toll that it takes on the people who are there and the importance of bearing witness, but also how hard it can be to bear witness. And she's very honest about that.
He was so polite. He thanked me for coming and asked me, with tears in his eyes, to come back. I didn't. Regret has preyed on me since that day. I think about every person I walked past without stopping to cry with them. My emotions took charge and my mind went on a vacation. Even though feeling everything was hard, it was better than not reaching out to connect with people. Perhaps this is the truest and strongest effect of war.
I think from my perspective as a journalist, I mean, Yemen is a complicated conflict, and there are certainly no shortage of horrors to pay attention to in the world. But I do believe, and I think this belief has been strengthened through working on this project with Nuha, that personal stories can be an opening for people to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that the world starts listening to Yemenis and starts paying attention. This war has been going on for 9 years. It is absolutely devastating. And as of now, there isn't a clear end in sight. So I hope that everyone will listen.
That was Annie Slemrod and Nuha Al-Junaid of the Yemen Listening Project. You can hear more clips from the Listening Project on yesterday's episode of The Monocle Daily on Monocle Radio. This is The Briefing. And finally, on today's show, Monocle's senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me here in the studio for a Latin American papers review. Good afternoon, Faye.
Good afternoon, Chris. Plenty of very important stories today.
Lots of important stories. The last one, obviously, the most important of them all, and we'll get to that in a moment. But we are starting with more Jair Bolsonaro news. First, he hid in Florida, I remember, at the time after the elections that he lost. Now, apparently, he hid in the Hungarian embassy.
That's such a strange story. That's the main story in Brazil at the moment. It's in the front page of Folha de São Paulo. But before I tell you the story, I have to say, the story, actually, it was from the New York Times. They are the ones who found the footage and published first time the images of Jair Bolsonaro entering the Hungarian embassy in Brasilia. He spent 2 days there, 2 full days. So he slept at the embassy. And, you know, it's very strange because it's been just a few days after his passport was confiscated by the federal police. You know, he's being indicted for all sorts of reasons. And I have to say, Chris, that was the 12th of February as well. So it was carnival time. So a lot of the people that work at the embassy, they were on holiday. So it's quite was also a very discreet time for Bolsonaro to go there. And there's been some, you know, dispute in the Brazilian press, but he could have avoided potential prison being at the embassy as well. We're not sure. I saw different opinions online about that.
Do we imagine he was almost like asking for extradition? Well, the opposite of extradition, sort of political asylum in Hungary, sort of Julian Assange-like, who is, of course, also, for that matter, a decision on his extradition is coming today.
Yes. I mean, of course, that's not what happened. I mean, he's out of the embassy. He's not there yet. But it's interesting that
he's considering, perhaps.
He was considering. He was just saying,
his options.
And it's funny, the Hungarian embassy in Brazil is not even the prettiest one. We have amazing embassies there. That one actually looked a bit like a prison in a way. Sorry, you know, I don't want to be offensive to them. But, you know, but yeah, and he's saying, I mean, in his defense, he was saying that he was just there because that's normal, a former president to visit an embassy. You know, it was just two countries that were cordial and he had amazing relations with Hungary. In fact, Hungary was one of the few allies of Brazil under the Bolsonaro regime.
Totally normal to visit an embassy, perhaps not to overnight, but we'll leave it there for the moment. We have other news on the political front because France's Emmanuel Macron is in Brazil today. It's his first visit.
That's his first visit. That's the story from O Estado de São Paulo. That's surprising. You know, that's the first visit of a French president in about 10 years. And I have to say, Brazil and France, they have incredible, you know, commercial relations. One interesting fact I found out reading, you know, about his visit, that France is the biggest foreign employer in Brazil because of the French companies that are. And Macron's not coming alone. He's coming with 120, you know, CEOs, representatives, including the CEO of Carrefour, which is, you know, the supermarket chain.
It's all about the business opportunities, isn't it?
It's all about the business opportunities. But also, let's talk about the controversies here. I think Macron is the one that didn't really want the EU-Mercosur deal, you know, because he's a bit of a protectionist. And I think Brazil also has some protectionist tendencies.
Well, particularly with the farmers' protests in Europe, Macron kind of reversed his position on this and kind of stopped the trade deal with Mercosur, didn't he? Yeah,
absolutely. But he can still do business in Brazil. I think he's going to Rio. Brazil is building some submarines to France. So there's so many things that Macron is doing in Brazil. I think they're important countries. There are allies and they have disagreements. Let's talk about the war in Ukraine. They have very different views on that. But also, it's a much better relationship than what France had with Bolsonaro. I think even Macron said, I mean, basically the relationship between both countries was literally frozen for 4 years. I'm not saying it's perfect now, but it is, you know, an improvement for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. A shift from Bolsonaro's days to Lula there. Well, let's move on to really the biggest news of all. I mean, come on, this is what we should have started the show with, if we're being honest here. Madonna is coming to Brazil. It's official.
And we have a clip of it, which we're going to listen to it right now.
Brazil, I am coming soon.
It gives me shivers. I mean, that's magical. But Chris, yes, I've been talking about it a few days ago here in Monaco, but it's been confirmed. The 4th of May, Madonna will be performing a free gig at Copacabana Beach, right in front of the iconic Copacabana Palace Hotel. It is expected that more than 1 million people will be attending. So that's, we're talking big numbers here. It's like the New Year's party. It's the same.
Huge, huge, huge numbers. But tell us also about this tradition that has now developed at the Copacabana. I mean, she's not the first one to do this, although it sounds like it might be the biggest.
I hope it's going to be the biggest, but you're right. I think it's the same thing that brought the Rolling Stones back in 2006. And again, I think it was one of the biggest concerts in their career. I think there's a certain cachet to be performing at Copacabana Beach. It's not for anyone. You need to be iconic because you'll be performing, according to the press release I wrote, in the biggest dance floor in the world. I mean, it is magical. And as I said, it was very strange being in Brazil just a few weeks ago that there were posters of Madonna everywhere. She's the poster girl of a Brazilian bank, Itaú, who is celebrating 100 years. I have a feeling they spent a lot of money on that. And even the Secretary of Tourism in Rio, she wrote a personal letter to Madonna asking for the concert just to be in Rio because they wanted to be special. That's her only concert in South America this time, but it's going to be ultra special.
Will it be an extra special show, do you think?
Absolutely. It's going to be live on TV as well, on Globo, our biggest channel. I'll be watching for sure. Who knows? Maybe I can go. I don't know.
I'm keeping
my options open.
Still thinking about it. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thanks very much for joining us. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle. Our researcher was George Ruskin. And our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.